A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The PA has struggled with legitimacy issues at home. It's seen by many Palestinians as ineffectual and at times even as an enforcer of Israeli security measures rather than a champion for their national aspirations.
What happened in 1993 is, of course, Israel and the PLO signed the Oslo agreements, and the Palestinian Authority was established actually as an administrative subsidiary of the PLO. The conventional wisdom, until about a year or two ago, I would say, was that if new Palestinian elections were held, and bear in mind, the situation was that Hamas was in hegemonic control of the Gaza Strip, and the PA was in hegemonic control of parts of the West Bank. Ideally, I think most people would like to see it with an end to the Israeli occupation, and they see the PA as an impediment to the Palestinian struggle against occupation.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
It's never been a good bet to bet against America.
A stronger NHS, better schools, safer streets, control of our borders, protecting and building an economy that embraces the opportunities of Brexit.
Hi, hello and welcome. I'm Roger Brown in Birmingham. In today's episode of Mid-Atlantic, we're diving into the intricate and highly charged realm of West Bank Palestinian politics with our special focus on Mahmoud Abbas and Fatah. Joining us is Moeen Rubani, who is a senior fellow at the Institute of the Palestine Studies and the co-editor of...
I'm in fact not affiliated with the Institute for Palestine Studies.
Yeah. But... you are still a contributing editor to the Middle East Report.
Correct.
And you were previously the UN Special Envoy to Syria.
Yes.
There you go. So the Palestinian Authority, primarily led by the secular political party Fatah, has long been recognized as a governing body in the West Bank. Established in the mid-1990s through the Oslo Accords, the PA was envisaged as a stepping stone towards an independent Palestinian state. However, the path has been somewhat anything but straightforward. The PA, while internationally recognized, has struggled with legitimacy issues at home. It's seen by many Palestinians as ineffectual and at times even as an enforcer of Israeli security measures rather than a champion for their national aspirations. Leadership under Mahmoud Abbas, who has been at the helm since Yasser Arafat's tenure, has faced significant criticism.
It was during a meeting with the different factions of his Fatah party that the Palestinian president made the announcement. Israel, he said, had given permission for a vote within the Palestinian territories, but had made clear this didn't include East Jerusalem. For Mahmoud Abbas, this was a red line.
أمام هذا الوضع الصعب قررنا تأجيل موعد إجراء الانتخابات التشريعية.
For many Palestinians, this would be their first ever vote. The last one was in 2006, a full 15 years ago. And delaying the election now over Jerusalem is seen by many as nothing more than a pretext to spare Abbas and his fractured party an embarrassing defeat. The decision also suits Israel and its allies, which are concerned about the growing strength of Hamas, the Islamist militant group that controls Gaza and is labelled as a terrorist organisation by much of the West, has denounced the delay to voting as a coup. Many Palestinians, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, are also keen to get the vote going ahead as planned, to send a message to the long-entrenched leadership that has failed to advance their hopes of statehood and is seen as increasingly corrupt and authoritarian.
Maureen, thank you for joining us on Mid-Atlantic, and thank you for joining me in somewhat chaotic circumstances. How are you today, sir, and where are you?
I'm good, thank you, and it's good to be with you, and I'm speaking with you from The Hague in the Netherlands.
Let's get straight to it, sir. I want to really look and try and understand, for our listeners, internal Palestinian politics.
The Fatah movement, which was established in the late 1960s, became really the backbone, the spinal cord, if you will, of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which was not so much a movement as an umbrella organization under which a variety of Palestinian political organizations operated. What distinguished Fatah was that, unlike, for example, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which was a Marxist organization, or any number of other factions within the PLO that were more or less directly sponsored by one or another Arab government, the Fatah movement had a very broad base. In other words, it did not have a clear ideology other than Palestinian nationalism, and it included within its ranks people who were communists, people who were Islamists, people who were just straight-up nationalists, and all the rest. Secondly, it didn't have a particularly privileged relationship with any one Arab government. Now, what happened in 1993 is, of course, Israel and the PLO signed the Oslo agreements. And the Palestinian Authority was established actually as an administrative subsidiary of the PLO. In other words, the Palestinian Authority was established by the PLO to discharge those functions that were transferred by Israel to the PLO under the terms of the Oslo agreements. What happened in...
Maureen, just 1 second, just so I get my timeline completely sorted here.
Yes.
The PLO is going to recognize the state of Israel in the mid-1980s.
Yes.
So this is pre the Oslo Peace Accords.
In the late 1980s, it formally recognized Israel.
Yeah. Is the PLO going to be the only significant Palestinian faction to ostensibly to recognize the state of Israel back then?
That's an interesting question. So the status of the PLO is the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. Uh-huh. The PLO is not so much an organization as an umbrella under which all these different organizations existed, with the exception, which we'll get to later, of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And it was the PLO which, in its capacity as the representative of all these factions, of all Palestinians, that it recognized Israel. None of its constituent members, including Fatah, actually recognized Israel, for the same reason that no political parties recognize other states. So none of the Israeli political parties, for example, recognized the PLO. It was the Israeli government recognized it. So in 1994, Palestinian authorities established as a subsidiary of the PLO, but what we saw quite rapidly was that the center of gravity of Palestinian politics shifted from the PLO to the PA. Yasser Arafat, Palestinian leader at the time, became president of the PLO and, sorry, of the Palestinian Authority and a number of other factions within the PA. And over time, you had an inversion of the relationship between the PLO and the PA, so that the PLO became almost, in practice, an agency of the PA rather than the other way around. But as you mentioned in your introductory comments, the Fatah movement was very much the backbone of the Palestinian Authority. And this had to do, I think, also with Arafat's style of rule. and the, let's say, the organic relationship between the Fatah movement and the PA persisted until Arafat was removed from the scene in 2004. He was succeeded by Mahmoud Abbas, who had a very different style of rule. Arafat encouraged the development of multiple rival power centers, a divide and rule policy, if you will, whereas Mahmoud Abbas took a much stricter line. His approach was very much my way or the highway. And in fact, one development under Abbas's leadership has been essentially the disintegration of the Fatah movement. And you began to see, in many respects, a clear distinction between the Fatah movement on the one hand and the Palestinian Authority on the other. So your characterization of the Palestinian Authority as being an extension of the Fatah movement, I think that was fairly true in the 1990s and the first decade of this century, but doesn't really hold today. There's now, I think, a fairly clear separation between the two, in part also because the Fatah movement has been completely crushed by Abbas, who, rather than promoting power centers within it, has sought to weaken the movement as a whole so that he has better control over Palestinian institutions.
So how would he characterize the organization, which is the legitimate party which is running PA? Bearing in mind, there's elections in 2006.
Yeah.
And we know, maybe run us through what happened there.
Yeah, so Arafat dies, or as most people, most Palestinians believe, was killed in 2004. These various competing power centers within Fatah that we were just discussing reach a consensus that he should be succeeded by Mahmoud Abbas, who had also been designated as the successor by Yasser Arafat. And he was seen as someone who was rather weak and nondescript. He was the lowest common denominator. Those who threw their support behind him felt they could control him, but he ended up outsmarting them all. And two elections were held. In 2005, presidential elections were held, which Abbas won. And those were elections that Hamas did not contest. And then in 2006, elections for the Palestinian Legislative Council, which is the parliament representing Palestinians only in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, those were held. And on this occasion, Abbas sought to persuade Hamas to participate in those elections. He felt that if Hamas participated in those elections, it would achieve a number of seats in the parliament, but not enough to have a veto, and that by entering Palestinian institutions, Hamas would be bound by their decisions without having the numbers to block those decisions. Hamas, for its part, which, as I mentioned earlier, had not been a member of the PLO, had boycotted the Palestinian Authority, its institutions, and its earlier 1996 elections, in the context of the Second Intifada, saw an opportunity to translate its growing popularity into institutional power. And it accepted to participate in the 2006 legislative elections.
I think that what you said there is really quite key, because that's what I really want to understand. By 2005, 2006, the dream of a Palestinian state organically coming from the Oslo Peace Accords is gone.
It was never part of the Oslo Peace Accords. That's, I think,
true. You know,
people expected it.
Exactly.
Yes.
So that has gone. So yes. When Abbas is running to be president and then of the Legislative Council with Fatah, they're already, in effect, collaborating with the Israelis, believing that there isn't going to be a Palestinian state and the Israelis are building new settlements.
Yes, I would put that slightly differently. I would say that Abbas's policy had been that he has to prove his reliability as a partner in order to make diplomatic progress. And of course, it was a completely mistaken assumption because he
partner to whom exactly?
Excuse me?
a partner to whom exactly?
He had to, in his view, I think initially he didn't have high expectations of the Israelis. Rather, he thought either he could persuade the Israelis he was a reliable partner and that Israel would therefore relinquish its occupation. And if it didn't, he would prove to the Americans, who were the hegemonic sponsors of the so-called peace process, that he was a reliable partner, and the Americans were then supposed to use their leverage with the Israelis to promote the establishment of a Palestinian state. And none of that, of course, happened, nor was it going to happen. But Abbas's motivations with the 2006 legislative elections were twofold. First of all, to integrate Hamas into Palestinian institutions on his own terms, as we just discussed. And secondly, to in fact weaken the Fatah movement, because he initially saw the Fatah movement and its rival power centers rather than Hamas as a main threat to his rule. Now, Fatah is also a rather ill-disciplined movement. So when these elections came, in many constituencies, Fatah couldn't agree on a slate of candidates. And so you had the official candidates, and then you had Fatah candidates who were excluded from the official list running as a separate list. So in quite a few constituencies, Hamas won by getting a plurality rather than a majority of votes. In effect, victory was handed to them in many instances by Fatah's disorganization. What happens?
What was the distribution of those votes? Heavily in Gaza? Did they have some in the West Bank? Give us a sense of the geographical spread.
I can't recall it quite clearly, but I do recall, for example, one place that's been in the news very often recently, Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, that was actually won by Fatah. Then you have other places in the West Bank that were won by Hamas. I believe Hebron was one of them. But in many places, Hamas won parliamentary seats with a plurality rather than a majority of the votes. But when you translate that into parliament, it won overwhelmingly. It established a veto-proof majority of seats in parliament.
The Palestinian presidential elections in 2005 were a significant event, marked by the election of Mahmoud Abbas as president of the Palestinian Authority on January 9, 2005. Abbas, from the Fatah party, won approximately 62% of the vote, succeeding Yasser Arafat, who had passed away in November 2004. The elections were seen as a crucial step towards resuming peace talks with Israel, with Abbas being viewed as a moderate compared to Arafat. In 2006, the Palestinian legislative elections took place on January 25th. These elections were notable for the significant victory of Hamas, an Islamist political and militant group, which won 74 of the 132 seats in the Palestinian Legislative Council. Fatah, which had been the dominant party in Palestinian politics, won only 45 seats. The victory of Hamas was unexpected and led to significant changes in Palestinian politics.
Now, many people point to the PA's ineffectiveness, its corruption, and similar failings as the main explanation for Fatah's loss in those elections, or, for example, to the organizational chaos that we were just discussing. Yeah. I look at it rather differently. There was corruption, there was disorganization, and all these other things. But ultimately, Fatah's political project of establishing an independent, sovereign Palestinian state in the occupied territories on the basis of negotiations with Israel had failed. And in my view, that was the main factor. In other words, if Fatah had contested those elections as a ruling party of an independent Palestinian state with its electoral headquarters in the Palestinian capital of East Jerusalem, I feel it could have been 10 times as corrupt and it would have still won. And so it's in that context that you begin to see the schism developing in the Palestinian political arena. Hamas entered parliament with an absolute majority, acting as if history begins today with our victory. Whereas Fatah's attitude was, we've been in charge for 40 years, So us losing this election is essentially irrelevant. That's the long and short, to give it a simplistic explanation. And Hamas formed a government, but it was prevented from governing through constant sabotage, administrative sabotage, if you will, by Fatah, which they were still in the civil service. Abbas was still president, and so on. And in the end, in 2007, after the failure of a number of agreements between these two movements, one of the key Fatah figures, Muhammad Dahlan, who is now at very strong loggerheads with Mahmoud Abbas, but was his closest aide at the time, at the instigation also of the United States and of Elliot Abrams in particular, was preparing to launch a coup in the Gaza Strip to oust Hamas from power. Hamas launched a preemptive coup, if you will, and seized power in the Gaza Strip and has been ruling it ever since.
Explain the relationship between Israel and the PA. How exactly does the PA see that relationship in reality? Mm-hmm. And how does the average Palestinian on the West Bank view that relationship?
The PA perceived itself as an interim institution, as a state in gestation, as the body which would lay the basis for the institutions of an independent Palestinian state at the conclusion of the Oslo Agreement. That conclusion of the Oslo Agreement, of course, never came, and so the PA has lived in indefinite suspension. Now, the PA has both civil and security functions, so it's responsible for providing civil services, health, education, and so on, more or less to the entire Palestinian population of the occupied territories, whereas its security functions are primarily limited to what is called Area A, effectively the main towns and cities in the West Bank and some villages. But most of the West Bank is still under direct and exclusive Israeli control, what's called Area C.
Let's understand what is meant in the West Bank by Areas A, B, and C. Area A covers approximately 18% of the West Bank, including major Palestinian cities like Ramallah, Bethlehem, and Nablus. Here, the Palestinian Authority, PA, has full administrative and security control. This area is where most governmental functions and Palestinian urban life are concentrated. Area B comprises about 22% of the West Bank and includes many Palestinian towns and villages. In this area, the PA holds administrative control and is responsible for civil matters, but Israel retains overriding security authority. This often leads to complex interactions between Palestinian residents and Israeli security forces. Area C, the largest segment covering about 60% of the West Bank, remains under full Israeli military and administrative control. This area includes key strategic zones such as the Jordan Valley, Israeli settlements, military bases, and land reserves. It is also where all building and infrastructure development requires Israeli approval, which is rarely granted for Palestinian residents, leading to significant disputes and international scrutiny.
And what happened during the Second Intifada is that Israel invaded Area A, it broke the back of the Palestinian Authority, and essentially in the years since, particularly under Mahmoud Abbas, it has, in the eyes of most Palestinians, become an extension of the occupation, a subcontractor of the occupation, in which its main functions are to prevent Palestinian resistance to Israel and its occupation, to work closely with the Israeli security forces to prevent attacks, but unable to defend its own people from the attacks of either the Israeli military or Israel's increasingly rampaging settlers. So now, for example, you read about these constant attacks by the Israeli army and settlers on villagers in the West Bank, resulting in straightforward ethnic cleansing in some of these rural areas. And the PA literally does nothing to oppose it. It not only does not have the authority to operate in those areas, but it doesn't even go through the motions of defending its own people. And it's gotten to the point where, since the Second Intifada, the Israeli military routinely launches incursions into areas that are supposed to be under the exclusive security jurisdiction of the Palestinian Authority. But even in those cases, the Palestinian Authority security forces do not resist these Israeli incursions. And they work very closely together now.
Off the back of what you just said there, Moeen, there is significant public desire for change.
Yes.
From average Palestinians on the West Bank. The Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey and Research did a poll in 2023, so that 90% of respondents believe that Abbas should resign. Moreover, 60% support the complete dismantlement of the PA.
Mm-hmm.
So if the PA is going to be dismantled, what would be in its place?
It's a very good question. And I think many Palestinians, most Palestinians, or the overwhelming majority of them, according to this poll, they see Mahmoud Abbas as an ineffective, largely absent leader who has become completely out of touch with his people, with their aspirations, with their urgent needs, and so on. And they see the Palestinian Authority as no longer an agency of the PLO or an interim phase between occupation and independence, but rather as, let's say, the native extension of the foreign occupation, a pillar of Israeli rule, which is funded by the EU and others, relieving Israel of the burden of having to do these things itself. And I don't think people who call for the dismantlement of the PA, or at least many of them, have really thought through what should take its place. I think they're looking at the PA as an institution that either always has been or certainly has become an obstacle to their aspirations, and therefore conclude, if this is the role it's playing, we might as well be rid of it. It's not so much that we want it, ideally, I think most people would like to see it with an end to the Israeli occupation, and they see the PA as an impediment to the Palestinian struggle against occupation. But in terms of what should replace it other than Palestinian sovereignty, I don't think many people have really thought that through. There have been discussions, for example, that the relationship between the PLO and the PA needs to be reconsidered, that once again, it should be the PLO that's in charge, with the PA as a local administrative agency, discharging civil functions and so on. So the PA, it doesn't need a president, it doesn't need a prime minister, it doesn't need all this pomp and ceremony, it should just exist as an administrative body, and that all the political roles and political decision-making and so on should revert to the PLO, which, unlike the PA, has a national rather than territorial function.
With the current war in Gaza, without going into too much of the whys and wherefores, how has that changed or at least affected West Bank Palestinian politics?
If you speak specifically about the West Bank, I think it's affected it in several ways. Most importantly, even before the war started, as we were just discussing, the legitimacy of the PA and the legitimacy of Abbas in particular had been in precipitous decline. And I think the role he has played during the past 7 months, or the role he hasn't played really, he's given no indication of leading his people through this time of genocide and trial and tribulation. He's almost been a powerless spectator. There's no indication that this is someone who's leading his people. So it's whatever was left of it has plummeted. At the same time, Hamas's stock has been rising quite strongly in the West Bank. The conventional wisdom, until about a year or two ago, I would say, was that if new Palestinian elections were held, and bear in mind, the situation was that Hamas was in hegemonic control of the Gaza Strip, and the PA was in hegemonic control of parts of the West Bank where Israel wasn't ruling. The conventional wisdom was Fatah would win in the Gaza Strip and Hamas would win in the West Bank. I don't think that's any longer the case. I don't think the PA or the Fatah movement these days could win any election after their absence, to put it mildly, during this war.
If you're Mahmoud Abbas and you're called to account for what you've done since 2005, and bearing in mind that he's gone way past his term limit, he cancelled.
Yes, he's in the 18th year of his 4-year term or 5-year term.
And he cancelled elections back in, what, 2021. Yes. What would he point to as being his key achievements for the Palestinian people?
I suspect the final years of Arafat's rule were very chaotic. You had the Second Intifada. You also had the Palestinian Authority becoming very much a reflection of Arafat's personal style of rule. And when Arafat was removed from the scene, there were actually quite a few Palestinians who felt, now we can rebuild our institutions. Many people believed that Abbas would sponsor those aspirations of rebuilding Palestinian institutions so that they could operate independently of the will of a particular leader. But what we've seen is that actually Abbas's rule has made people nostalgic for Arafat's worst years. Institutions have been thoroughly decimated. We've seen levels of internal.
But Moeen, but you know what? The Mahmoud Abbas wouldn't say that. I says, what do you say? He said his achievements would be. You'll give me a critique of his time in power.
Fair
which
point.
Is incredibly.
And perhaps relevant. The reason is that I'm searching for what excuse he would make for himself. But I think what he would say is, I had a strategy, and my strategy was to remove the chaos and remove the militancy from the Palestinian movement. In other words, to get rid of all these militias and so on, to show myself to be a reliable diplomatic partner so that progress could be made towards an independent Palestinian state. I did my part. The Israelis went off the deep end to the radical right and didn't reciprocate. And my backup plan, which was to partner not with the Israelis, but with the Americans so that they would use their influence with the Israelis, that failed too. I think if he were asked to account for himself, that's probably what he would say. And he would lay the blame for his failure at the feet of the Israelis and the Americans.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST. And up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Would he even say it's failure? And then there's one more question from me after this. I'm going to throw this out to the audience. Would he even say it's failure? He could surely point to the war in Gaza and say, look, with those radicals, and as you've called them, this is what we've got. 34,000 Palestinians dead, the Gaza Strip decimated. What I have done is at least kept the embers alive of a nascent Palestinian state.
Well, what I mean by his failure is that he came in with a very clear political program to which he would entertain no alternatives. And that program was the establishment of an independent Palestinian state on the basis of bilateral negotiations with Israel under exclusive U.S. sponsorship. That state hasn't materialized. It's actually farther away than ever on his watch. And so I think he would explain his program. I think he would then have to recognize that he hasn't achieved those objectives, and he would lay the responsibility for the failure to reach those objectives on the Israelis, on the Americans, and probably, as you mentioned, also at the feet of Hamas. But he doesn't strike me as a type that would accept any responsibility for these failures himself.
Last question from me before I throw this out to the audience and to everybody who's watching this, and this looks a little bit odd because I'm actually recording this on my phone. Technical kerfuffles here in Birmingham in England, but at least we're still going through with the interview. So hopefully the weird camera angles hasn't spoiled anybody's enjoyment of this interview too much. Last question from me. Obviously, Abbas isn't going to last forever. What are his plans for succession? Who comes next? And what type of leader would they be? And what policies would they institute vis-a-vis Palestinian statehood?
Here again, it's useful to back up a bit to Arafat's final years, where he was always accused, in many respects rightly, of becoming increasingly autocratic. But at least he designated a successor. And the succession after he was removed from the scene was actually quite smooth. Abbas has resisted appointing a successor because, in his view, the moment he does appoint one, given his advanced age and failures and all the rest of it, he immediately becomes a lame duck. A person who has been, at least in some respects, designated as a successor is Hussein al-Sheikh, who I believe is the Secretary General of the Executive Committee of the PLO. But the problem is you have all these different institutions and they all have different succession mechanisms. For example, for the Palestinian Authority, if the president dies or becomes incapacitated, he's replaced on an interim basis by the Speaker of the Parliament, the Legislative Council. That speaker happens to be Aziz al-Dwaik from Hamas. That's not going to happen. So what many people are expecting are one of two scenarios, and this goes back to the disintegration of the Fatah movement, that let's say that tomorrow morning we wake up and there is no Abbas, that there would be considerable infighting among leading Fatah elements because there is no clear succession plan. And what I've been saying for many years is the Palestinian succession is unfortunately not just a Palestinian affair. There's a lot of foreign influence these days on Palestinian politics, particularly from Israel and from the United States. And Israel, since 2000, has reverted to unilateralism. In other words, it no longer feels it needs a Palestinian partner to sign on the dotted line. And it may well choose to prevent the emergence of a new Palestinian Authority leader and instead seek to promote the further fragmentation of Palestinian politics and Palestinian society by seeking, for example, to strengthen a warlord in the southern West Bank, one in the central West Bank, one in the northern West Bank, things of this nature. It's, I think, extremely difficult to give a straightforward answer to your admittedly straightforward question about the Palestinian succession.
You're listening to a recording of the podcast Mid-Atlantic. Mid-Atlantic has been around for 10 years. This is our 11th year. And primarily what we look at is US and UK politics compared and contrasted. But we do widen our net to geopolitics. I make no apologies for being pro-Palestinian statehood. As somebody who has believed it since the age of 10, it's really a great passion of mine. Yes, I believe Israel has a right to exist. I've been to Israel, had an amazing time there. And I believe the two things are not mutually exclusive.
the two peoples need to be able to find an accommodation for them to live together. I have a Substack. It's royfield.substack.com. If you're listening to the podcast, why don't you just go over to the Substack, just sign up, become a member. Don't ask for any money. If you want to give me money, that's great. But what we need to do is build a coalition of people throughout the world who are, yes, they're left-leaning, but also they want to reach out and listen to the other side. That's the only way we can co-opt and get people behind us for change. And one of the changes we need is a Palestinian state. We do have a small but perfectly formed audience. If you're in the audience and you'd like to ask Moeen a question, now is your time to shine. Quite simply, come off mic and you can pose your question to Mr. Rabbani. And don't be shy. After that fantastic introduction, Andrew, my good friend, do you have a question all the way from Canada?
Hi, Royfield. Yeah, I'm here in Canada too, so not too far from Montreal. This is it's so bleak. And I'm just wondering, given what you've been saying today in terms of the way the PA is basically just ineffectual now, it's probably, for the most part, politically non-existent. Is there an appetite in the Palestinian movement at all towards the two-state solution, or is there some other agenda that they're favoring more so than that eventuality? Is it even there anymore? And because it doesn't seem to be on either side. Now, I'm not just pointing the fingers at the Palestinians. Obviously, in Israeli politics right now, with Netanyahu at the helm over the last couple decades, that his efforts towards subverting that agenda is, I think, fairly obvious. And I'm just wondering, is there an appetite at all in within the Palestinian population to pursue a two-state solution? Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I think you were asking two questions, one about Palestinian politics and one about Palestinian popular opinion. If you were to look at the formal positions of Palestinian leaderships, those have been now for decades. I'm talking about the PLO, I'm talking about the PA, I'm talking about the Fatah movement, and to a lesser extent, some of the other PLO movements, such as the Democratic Front for Palestine, the People's Party, and so on. They have formally endorsed the two-state settlement, and that remains their official policy. Then you have Hamas, which in 2017 also formally adopted the two-state framework. The question, so I don't think there's any doubts about the commitments of many of Palestine's political elite, if you will, towards a two-state settlement. As far as public opinion goes, it's a little different story. And if you look at public opinion polls over the past decade or two, if I'm not mistaken, you'll see a rather significant fluctuation in support for a two-state settlement, optimism, pessimism about it, support shifting towards one-state solution. And my own view is that public opinion under conditions such as those in which the Palestinians live, tend to be quite fickle, in the sense that they're often statements of assessment to the current situation more than they are statements of principle, if that makes sense. In other words, if you were to ask someone, do you support a two-state settlement, I think they'd be more inclined to tell you to respond on the basis of how practical or feasible they think it is based on conditions at that time, as opposed to giving you their preferences. And that, in my view, explains the significant fluctuations. Now, last part of my response to your question is, what has the effect of the current war been? My suspicion is that you will have many people who may still believe that a two-state settlement is feasible, but who will now reach the conclusion that in the wake of these events and Israel's genocidal onslaught on the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip, that it's no longer desirable, and that so long as this regime and its institutions persist, there can be no peace between Israel and the Palestinians, and there can be no peace in the Middle East. I think that's certainly also a growing feeling among Arab public opinion. I do think that your bleakness about the prospects of a two-state settlement is in many respects justified. And I would add that I think it's the last 7 months that probably account for a considerable part of that bleakness. Also because, as we were discussing earlier, a two-state settlement was never on the agenda of the Oslo Agreement, but nevertheless, everyone expected that would be its outcome. And we're now, I think, 31 years into Oslo's 9-year process, or whatever it was supposed to be, and Palestinian state appears further away than ever. And you can't have a two-state settlement without ending the occupation. And what we've seen is the occupation getting ever more entrenched.
Just on that, I think it's a really interesting dynamic. One of the things which I didn't touch upon, and I'm going to ask for your opinion now, most definitely at the start of the war on Gaza, there were mass demonstrations in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
That must have put a lot of political pressure on the PA to be to at least be overt and to be a banner and a standard bearer for the Palestinian people. But I think it's really interesting what you're saying, that this has moved for the average, let's say, Palestinian on the West Bank, and maybe the average Arab, has moved their thoughts away from a two-state solution because they're just angry. They're so angry. But it hasn't necessarily moved the needle with Arab governments.
Not at all.
So explain that dichotomy for us.
I think a two-state settlement remains the international consensus on a resolution of the question of Palestine. When you talk about Arab governments, these are governments that by and large have very close relations with the West and that are very keen also to prove their moderation, if you will. And in their estimation, a two-state settlement either remains feasible or remains the diplomatic program through which they feel they can address this issue and get a Western audience. The problem, of course, is the United States, United Kingdom, European Union, and so on, they keep talking about a two-state settlement, but it's become a meaningless slogan that never translates into policy. So I think at the public level, people hear these leaders who are either actively supporting or passively acquiescing in Israeli policy. When they talk about a two-state settlement, they see it as a diversionary charade that's not serious in intent, because they would say it can't possibly be the case that the world's most powerful countries all want a two-state solution, and with every passing year, Israel's occupation becomes more and more entrenched.
My friend in Serbia, you had a question you told me before the start of the interview. Would you like to pose it now?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Rabbani. I have so many questions, but I would like to hear your comment on the veto that happened in Security Council about Palestine statehood.
I think it was expected, but I think it's also a very good follow-up to the previous question. The United States claims it has embraced a two-state settlement. In the General Assembly, it votes against resolutions reaffirming the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. And in the Security Council, it consistently blocks Palestinian applications to become a full member of the United Nations. So again, there's a total disconnect between what they say and what they do. And I think Palestinians have learned to ignore what's being said and to focus on what's being done. You can say you support a Palestinian state and a two-state settlement all you want, but when all your actions point in the opposite direction, then people would stop taking these slogans seriously, and they see them as a fig leaf to hide the real policy.
I have one more question, if I may. So I'm assuming that you read the report from Francesco Albanese and the case for genocide. Do you believe this report will affect ruling on ICJ when time comes? And how much is important this report?
I don't know to what extent that report will have an influence on the International Court of Justice's consideration of this case. At one level, you would think that it would, because the ICJ itself is a UN institution, and this report was produced by a UN special rapporteur. I think it will have more influence if the South Africans, who are the ones who have brought this case before the court, use it as evidence in the hearings that are going to be held. In other words, in the next phase of this case, it will be South Africa, Israel, and other countries making presentations to the court's judges. And the extent to which they present this report as affirming their accusations, I think that's how it will be considered.
Thank you, Eco. L, you've come off mute.
Thank you. Hi there, Rayfield. Hi, Mr. Rabbani. I was interested in knowing whether you had any reaction to the uproar that's going on campuses across the United States, how you react to that, and whether you think it has, if you think it has any kind of significance right now.
Yes, I think it's highly significant. I remember reading an article in the New York Times long before this latest explosion of protests, in which the level of youth and activism, particularly on college campuses around the war on Gaza, was being compared to U.S. campuses during the Vietnam War, during the late 1960s and early 1970s. And what I find particularly interesting is that the level of activism around this war appears to exceed even that which we saw in 2002-2003 in response to the Iraq War, which I think is significant because in 2003, the U.S. was the chief protagonist, if you will, in Iraq, whereas here, people are protesting against their government's complicity. The other observation I would make is that you see the rules are being rewritten and freedoms are being restricted and unprecedented actions are being taken. Essentially, the rule book is being rewritten and freedoms are being suppressed for the benefit of Israel, for the benefit of suppressing criticism of Israel. And that, I think, is quite extraordinary. And then you had this, I thought, rather shameful performance by the president of Columbia University, who, by the way, is an Arab. She's Egyptian, Minouche Shafik. She was former leader of London School of Economics, if I'm not mistaken. She saw what happened to her counterparts from Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania, and chose a different approach, which was basically to pander to the radicals, radical Republicans in Congress. When you pander to bullies, you only whet their appetite. She went there and basically offered herself on a silver platter to some real lunatics there, saying, "You will be cursed by God if you don't praise Israel," or something to that effect. And they're still calling for her dismissal because you can never satisfy these people. When you give a bully an inch, he'll demand a mile. And that's exactly what, and it'd be very interesting to see if she survives into the next semester. I rather have my doubts.
I don't think she will. If you see what happened with Mike Johnson today, Barry, she
created
exactly what she was looking for. She got exactly that.
Yes. And I have to say, as wrong as any of this is, in her case, I can say with full confidence, she bought it upon herself. She could have stood up to them, but instead she decided to pander and fold in front of them.
Yeah, I agree.
Really interesting point you bring up there, Al and Mr. Rabbani. I've been incredibly informal. I've been calling you Moeen for the majority of this, and I never do that.
Feel free. No formalities required.
No, my parents would be horrified. The way in which the onslaught on Gaza has played out in domestic politics around the world as being profound.
Yes.
So much so that in my hometown of Birmingham, so the second biggest city in the UK, there are thousands of lampposts which are adorned with the Palestinian flag. People have gone up at the dead of night and hung flags there, and it's all over the city. We have mayoral elections in the metro region of the West Midlands. One candidate is standing on a Gaza platform. Mm-hmm. And he's not talking about getting the bins collected, cleaning up the streets, the typical things of mayoral. He mm-hmm. says, we need a Palestinian state. That is his platform. This has created massive ructions in the UK, not in the way that it has in the US, because we don't have the same level of culture wars in the way that it's played out in campuses in America. It does feel like an inflection point in the Palestinian struggle, because the Labour Party in the UK, this is an issue where they know they're losing young votes. They're going to lose votes in heavily Muslim areas. Ditto the Democratic Party to a much lesser degree in places like Michigan. So this is playing out. So just on the international response, how do you feel, or how do the Palestinians feel about the fact that Spain and Ireland have been so vociferous in terms of calling Israel to account and saying that they're going to formally recognize a Palestinian state?
Better late than never. But at the same time, I think it's Spain, Belgium, and Ireland, if I'm not mistaken, that would be a good move. But it's also not the priority now. In other words, there's the immediate crisis, which is Israel's genocidal assault in the Gaza Strip. And there's also, let's say, the diplomatic crisis, if you will, the occupation and the West's refusal to use its influence with Israel to bring it to an end that has brought us to this point. So I think Ireland has made some important statements about calling Israel to account. I think it's going to intervene in the case at the International Court of Justice and so on. But I would just be wary of initiatives that seek to address, let's call it again, the diplomatic crisis without also addressing the very urgent crisis in the Gaza Strip that's unfolding before our very eyes on a daily basis. More broadly, I think it's very encouraging. People used to avoid mentioning Palestine like the plague during election seasons. Palestine used to be an electoral burden, and expressing slavish support to Israel used to be an election winner. That seems to be changing. You now have, you know, if press reports are supposed to be believed, Biden's devotion to Israel may cost him the election. Who would have ever thought? It used to be that being critical of Israel cost you an election. Now it seems to be changing in the opposite direction. And I think particularly in countries with a more parliamentary systems, multi-party systems, where the margin of victory tends to be much smaller, I think their politicians will perhaps be more responsive to the views of their public, because it could make all the difference between winning and losing.
So I believe we have one more question from my good friend, Dr. Francine.
Oh, Mr. Rabbani, I am a person who looks at real estate deals, and I'm trying to figure out, if everybody decides in their infinite wisdom that a two-state solution should happen, where are they going to put it, since the Israeli settlements have taken over most of the West Bank? And has anyone even thought about that?
The only feasible two-state settlement would be an Israeli withdrawal to the 1967 boundaries with minor reciprocal and equal land exchanges. I think any two-state solution that takes as a premise that the settlements are here to stay is a non-starter, both because the main settlement blocks have often been designed to fragment Palestinian territorial contiguity, and also because they were often established on the prime real estate of what would become a Palestinian state. So again, I don't think Palestinians are prepared to pay the cost of Israel's decision to basically establish all these settlements with the ultimate goal of annexing those territories. Palestinians would say that's a problem for Israel, that's a problem for Israel's allies. Don't make it our problem, and certainly don't solve that problem at our expense. We tend to think of these radical, messianic extremists and so on, and there's certainly a lot of them. But an arguably larger part of the problem is that...
People.
Sorry?
They are people.
Yes.
They are people.
An arguably larger part of the problem is that the Israeli government has provided so many incentives for people to move to the West Bank for cost of living considerations, for having larger homes and so on, that I think you'd be surprised at how many of those settlers, at least in the past, would have been willing to relocate back to Israeli territory outside the 67 borders if those incentives were removed.
What I found sad, the confusing tapestry of the future. We have a disintegrating polity, which is nominally Palestinian on the West Bank, at a time when we have record levels of activism and support from around the world. And Elle, who asked your question, sent me a link for a Haaretz article of which one of their opinion writers says, Israel is suffering a historic and generational defeat with its actions in Gaza. And it's one thing for me, sat in the comfort of my home in Birmingham in England, to think that. It's another thing completely if Israelis are waking up to the level of diplomatic isolation and then the generational shift which is happening throughout the world, and the coalitional support which is happening for the Palestinian people, all while the traditional standard bearers of the vanguard of the Palestinian people, the Palestinian Authority through Fatah, whatever, is falling around its ears. So let's just hope that when it comes to the time to negotiate, whether that is 18 months, 5 years, time, that we have real representatives of the Palestinian people who are able to advocate for a just and equitable settlement sat opposite Israelis, because many Israelis are realizing that the prosecution of this war has been best counterproductive, and that Haaretz piece is a real eye-opener, a historic generational defeat for the Israeli nation. Just because you have more bombs and more tanks doesn't mean that you win hearts and minds and you win a political solution. Moin Rabbani, thank you for coming on to the show. So you're about to say something.
No, I was going to thank you as well.
Thank you for coming on to the show. If people want to catch up with your work online, how can they do that, sir?
I'm on Twitter with my at first and last name, and most of my material is also published on the website of Jadalia, that's www.jadalyya.com.
Will you come back then again, sir?
With pleasure.
Listen, it's been a total honor to have you. We did have Benny Morris on a few months ago going through 1948 and 1967, and it's really important for me not only to have a Palestinian on, but a Palestinian of some great repute and regards. And we did that today. Just before you go, how was it? How was that that four-way between Lex Fridman, Professor Finkelstein, Benny Morrison? I'm not even going to mention the other guy.
Interesting. Yeah, a 5-hour debate. I didn't expect it to be that long. So I'm surprised how many people have viewed it, because I mean, I'm in it and I haven't even had the patience to view a 5-hour video. So,
well, I watched it not all 5 hours. I watched, I think, about the first half an hour, and then I did start jumping forward. But anyway, listen, it's so great to have you on the
thank
show.
Thank you. It was and a real pleasure.
Thank you for joining the Mid-Atlantic family, and we'll hope to see you again soon.
Look forward to it. Thanks again.
Goodbye. Take care. All right, everybody. Thank you to the people who stayed around and been in the audience. This is a reason for you to join the Substack. If you join the Substack, royfield.substack.com, you do then get the post when I actually give out these links. So if you listen to the podcast, to the 5,000 people you download every episode, jump over onto the Substack. It's something new, which I'm trying to do to build community around these issues, but also to get really informed voices who could actually really explain the intricacies of the policies of the issues of which we are all interested about. I will say this in every podcast. Left to center politics is right thinking politics. Take care. Look after yourselves. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from L.A. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.